Hello, I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the very best of The Daily Show. On this bonus episode, we'll revisit the hottest topics, the best guests, the funniest interviews of the past week. So please remember to tune in to the regular show, Monday to Friday, 5 p.m. in your Mail Plus briefings, Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify. But for now, enjoy the show. Theresa May, in her first newspaper article since she stood down as Prime Minister, has issued her most strident criticism of Boris Johnson. She's accused him of abandoning Britain's position on global moral leadership. She wrote this piece to mark Joe Biden's inauguration in the United States. She said her successor has failed to honour British values by threatening to break international law in Brexit trade talks. If you remember, he was threatening to depart from the withdrawal deal struck with the EU. And he's also ripped up the foreign aid target of spending 0.7% of our gross domestic product on international aid. I wonder if her views strike a chord with many Tory MPs. Joining me now is one of them. He's Andrew Bridgen. He is the Conservative MP for Northwest Leicestershire. Andrew, I'm always surprised when a Prime Minister who was bundled out of office because she was perceived to be not a great leader by you and your colleagues, then lecture somebody who won a pretty big majority in December 2019 in the form of Boris Johnson.
Yes, and I think I was deeply concerned when Theresa May didn't stand down from Parliament after she was no longer Prime Minister. There's an old saying in politics, there's nothing more ex than ex Prime Minister. And she appears to haunt the back benches of the Conservative Party like Banquo's ghost after the murder. I think it's
some people would argue it's rather good of her to stay on as backbencher. She's got lots of experience. She was a Home Secretary for a very long time. She's been Prime Minister. She can be a source of advice to her successor.
Well, maybe. That may be her perception. I think she's, having read the article, it's dripping with bitterness and venom. And it's bringing back not my own personal memories, but collective recollections of Edward Heath sitting on the back benches during Margaret Thatcher's time as Prime Minister.
Yeah, and that was the longest sulk in political history. We can't have that.
We now need some optimism. I think Theresa May has broken one of the first rules of being a Conservative member of Parliament, is that you try to avoid blue-on-blue clashes in public, and she's gone, there's very little things more public than the front page of the Daily Mail. I think it reflects rather badly on her judgment to do that. But she's clearly staked out her position, but her position, from my perspective, is very weak. I mean, had we gone along with Theresa May's Chequers deal, which I think I was the first MP to put my vote of letter of no confidence publicly in, 2 days after the Chequers deal arrived, because as an arch Eurosceptic, I would have rather voted for us to stay in the European Union than accept the Chequers deal, because at least when we were in the European Union, we could leave. We would have become a vassal state. Instead of taking back control, we would have been effectively a colony of the EU, and that treaty would have been forever. So there would have been no way of ever escaping from it. It was a complete disaster and a betrayal of everything we promised the British people and everything that they voted for in the referendum. So that is her position. And the sad thing is, she still seems to believe that her deal was a good deal. And she talks about compromise and, we've got... I thought she was going to go off into sort of toxic masculinity at one stage and accuse Boris of that. And it's all right, this compromise with, on the world stage, but also being a Conservative. I mean, what we credit the Conservative Party with is that we know how the world is, we know how the world we'd like it to be, and it's a fatal mistake to get the two mixed up, and the world isn't like that. If Boris hadn't stood his ground and threatened the introduction of the internal markets bill when the EU negotiated in very bad faith, and I mean, who saw the withdrawal agreement as being interpreted as allowing the EU to effectively blockade Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK and potentially bring in tariffs between the UK mainland and Northern Ireland? I mean, that was what they were threatening us with. And people threaten you have to respond. Boris didn't actually break the international law, because all that legislation did was give the minister the ability to take the powers in the event of a no-deal Brexit where they blockaded Northern Ireland. Well, I mean, that seems like a reasonable response. At the end of the day, if your opponent's fighting in the gutter, you sometimes have to get down and dirty with them.
And just finally, what of Theresa May? You make the point you'd have preferred if she'd followed convention. Gordon Brown, Tony Blair, Mrs. Thatcher all went pretty quickly after they'd left Number 10. If you had advice for her, she's given advice to Boris Johnson in the Daily Mail today. What advice would you give to Mrs. May, Andrew Bridgen?
Well, I think what we always thought, what Theresa May was seen as, was she wasn't someone that people warmed to, but they respected, and they thought that she was, you know, had moral principles. And part of that is that you don't criticise so unfairly someone who's your successor. That's an easy thing to do. It actually diminishes Theresa May as a politician, not only within the Conservative Party but within the country. Boris has had a very difficult premiership. He's had some massive challenges, Brexit, COVID. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel, and now's the time for moving forward together. But I'm afraid I don't think Theresa May's actually on the team, having read the article today. And I think the public will come to judge whether the decision to remove her from office was the right one. I think the article, unfortunately, she's written today only demonstrates that it was.
Indeed, that's Andrew Bridgen. He's the Conservative MP for Northwest Leicestershire. Thanks for joining us. So remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News, and you'll get the latest from Mail Plus. And at 5, of course, you get to hear the latest daily show. Smart motorways present an ongoing risk of future deaths, a coroner warned yesterday at the inquest into two men killed on a stretch of so-called smart motorway, which, of course, has no hard shoulder. 38 people have been killed on smart motorways over a five-year period, the BBC reported. I'm joined now by Nick Lees, who's head of road policy at the RAC. Nick, for those who don't know what a smart motorway is, would you explain it?
Good afternoon, Andrew. Yes, so a smart motorway is a type of motorway that will either permanently or on a part-time basis take out the hard shoulder and convert it into a running lane. Alongside that, you will have refuge areas which effectively replace the hard shoulder, which are positioned at up to every 2.5 kilometres apart. You will also have technology on those motorways which will enforce variable speed limits, for example, as well. So it's a mixture of technology and increased capacity.
But the problem is they're not working, isn't that right? So, for instance, this coroner who referred to an accident on the motorway where two men were involved in a collision, there's no hard shoulder, of course. They did not take their cars to the refuge a bit further up the road. Perhaps they didn't know there was one up the road. They got out of their cars to exchange details. The cars passing didn't slow down, which would have alerted the authorities that there'd been potentially an accident, and a lorry crashed into them, killing them instantly.
Yeah, it's a very tragic indeed. And we have some serious concerns about the smart motorway designs. We think that the refuge areas are placed or positioned too far apart. And also we have a number of concerns about the technology which is not being used on these smart motorways. So you will have camera technology which is designed to be picked up by the control centres, but actually what you need is you need a smarter radar system which is able to detect when a vehicle has actually stopped in a live lane. So we have some serious concerns about these. Now, statistically speaking, Andrew, the smart motorways are about as safe as conventional motorways when you work out the number of collisions and the number of fatalities. But the concern that we have, certainly as a breakdown organisation, is that if you are in an unfortunate position whereby you are breaking down, and if you break down in the live lane and you're not able to get to these refuge areas, then you are at a substantially higher risk of being involved in a collision than if a hard shoulder was present.
And do people know where the refuge is?
Nick, for instance, these two men who were involved in the crash, one was 44, the other one 22, far too young to die, always too young to die in an accident like this. How would they have known there was a refuge just a little bit further up the motorway where they could have parked safely?
Well, that's a really good question. And certainly when these motorways were first implemented, there were no signs indicating that refuge areas where they were. Now, what's happened over the last year or two is that Highways England have started to put signs up saying emergency SOS area at 1 mile or in 400 yards or something like that. So it gives people an indication as to how far they are away from these refuge areas. But of course, the nature of a breakdown is you don't choose when and where to have a breakdown. Right. It simply happens. And if you're in the position where you've just passed a refuge area and there isn't one, another one for another two and a half kilometers, and say your tire has blown, then it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to get to that refuge area, which is why we need more of them. And what we've been saying to Highways England throughout this is that we feel that the scheme as it is unsafe. And actually, there are certain things that should be done to actually increase the safety of these motorways. Now, last year, the Department for Transport, which was led by Grant Shapps, put forward an evidence stock take and some key recommendations, and there were 18 recommendations in that. And one of the recommendations was to look at installing extra refuge areas and look at installing stop vehicle detection technology so we could actually make these safer. Now, that is all well and good, but a lot of these recommendations are not going to be implemented until 2023 at the earliest. So we really need to get moving on this.
And just finally, the point of these wretched motorways, it's to remove the hard shoulder to enable traffic to flow more speedily. Is that the point of them?
Yes. So what it is, and I've got to be, I suppose, slightly careful with what I say here. You say it's motorway expansion on the cheap. Now, it costs a lot of money to traditionally expand a motorway. So the Department for Transport, Highways England, looked at ways to increase capacity. Now, traffic will continue to increase once we come out of the pandemic. I think that is still going to happen. But it was a way to actually increase capacity on the network. And without doing it in the traditional sense, that would take a lot longer and would cost more money. So that's the reason. By listening to what I'm saying, you might think that everything about these motorways is negative. There are some good things about these motorways. For example, they have variable speed limits. They have more cameras on them to detect things. They have gantries above, so it gives people much clearer information as well. So there are some positives, but actually some of the negatives we think are too dangerous. And as I said, Andrew, it really is that situation that you're in if you break down, where the risks are much more heightened if you're stopping in a live lane. That's where our biggest concern lies.
So in an ideal world, would the RAC prefer that we don't have smart motorways?
I think we're a little bit too far down the road for that, excuse the pun. We've got around about 200 miles of all lane running smart motorways. It's clearly a policy decision that they're sticking with. I think in the ideal world, it would be great to have four lane motorways with a hard shoulder and with some of the technology that has, you've got a mixture of the technology that you use on smart motorways. That would be a great way of making our motorways as safe as possible. But I think when you look at the statistics overall, these smart motorways are about as safe as conventional motorways. It really is just about reducing that risk level when it comes to people breaking down. That's the most important thing, and that's the work that needs to be focused on.
All right, that's Nick Leese, who's head of road policy at the RAC. Thanks for joining us. So it was at the inquest of Jason Mercer, who was 44, who was killed by a lorry on the M1. The coroner, David Urquhart, said he would ask ministers for a safety review in the hope that lives can be saved. The victim's widow, Claire Mercer, has been campaigning for any more smart motorways to be put on hold until a public inquiry is held. Claire, thanks for coming on with us. And I'm so sorry, this is still very raw for you. It happened in June 2019. I know you, when the coroner delivered a verdict of unlawful killing, you cried. It's a sign, isn't it, in your campaign? It's a first step to protecting the lives of others.
Yes, it was like a physical blow, because obviously we've believed that, you know, it was his death was unnecessary and Alexandra's death was unnecessary. But people tend to think that we're just distraught relatives that have not come to terms with our loss. And especially early in the campaign, people would say, yes, but. And, you know, it was a lot of the time it was, yes, but why did they stop? It doesn't matter why they stopped. The penalty for making a very simple mistake that a lot of people make is not a violent and traumatic death. But as 18 months has passed and people have become more aware of what a smart motorway is, we don't get that anymore, because people are rightly outraged at what a smart motorway actually is and the dangers it puts you in. So for someone in the powers of the coroner's office to say, yes, these people were unlawfully killed and Highways England were partly to blame, it was like a punch in the guts. But, you know, in a bad way, because my husband didn't just die, he was killed unlawfully. But it was also good, because now this will really help the campaign. It'll help us push through a lot more legally binding actions.
It must be extra hard for you, Claire, because your husband, he joined the northbound carriageway of Junction 34 at around 8:15 a.m. And it was a very minor collision with Alexander Murgano's lorry. They got out of their vehicles to do the right thing, exchange details, and then they were struck by another lorry. That driver of that lorry, of course, is now in prison. No comfort to you, of course.
No. I mean, he didn't get up that morning intending to kill two people, and he's admitted that he wasn't paying attention. And every single driver in the universe loses attention sometimes. It's just 99% of the time, it doesn't result in two deaths. But as the coroner said, as the police said yesterday, as even Highways England, two different Highways England staff were forced to admit, Jason and Alexandra would not be dead if there'd been a hard shoulder.
Yeah. Now, what you've had this important victory in the coroner's court, unlawful killing. Where do you go now with this, Claire?
Well, the unlawful killing side of it is very important, because up to now, I've been battling with South Yorkshire Police to get them to investigate Highways England for corporate manslaughter, and they've been not doing it. I don't know what the reasons are behind the scenes. I get half answers sometimes, but they four times now they've rejected my report for, you know, corporate manslaughter. Four times I've gone through the IOPC and now to the Crime Commissioner's office. But now that a coroner has said they were unlawfully killed and Highways England were partly to do with it, I can't see how they can possibly not investigate it. They did a great big and very detailed investigation into the lorry driver that would have only ever done it once, but they're refusing point blank to do an investigation into the organisation that has now done it 44 times in 5 years. So yeah. I can't see how they can possibly justify now. So it's going to really help me push them for corporate manslaughter charges.
And of course, you know this better than anyone, Claire. The inquest looked at the safety failures on the day of the tragedy. Crucially, a sensor system to detect traffic problems, known as MIDAS, didn't work because the passing vehicles, as they passed your husband's vehicle, didn't slow down. And there was also a flaw in the system for human monitoring of cameras in a regional control centre. Two fatal flaws, which the inquest effectively said were responsible for your husband's death.
Yes, I mean, I have done a lot of research into smart motorways and what's involved, and we've had a lot of people contact us. We have Highways engineers contact us. We have camera operators contact us. We knew that monitoring the cameras wasn't their only job. But yesterday, because they were under oath, the Highways England staff had to admit that, one, it's not their priority. They're called camera operators. How is monitoring the cameras not their priority? And two, that it's scrolling screens, there's blind spots in a lot of areas. So as he said yesterday, one of the people, I believe it was the head of design, there's 100% coverage of the motorway, but not all the time. It's all these hidden little details. Oh, we have 100% coverage of the motorways, but not all of the time, because the cameras are scrolling. Highways didn't even have footage of the crash originally. So they couldn't even tell me what happened between Jason and Alexandra in the first place. We had to prove it to them by getting photos off their own phones.
Terrible. If I can ask you just finally, Claire, has this victory at the coroner's court, unlawful killing, has that brought you any comfort at all at the loss of your husband?
In some ways, because it's officially recognised, because at the moment, Jason doesn't have any legacy of any type. He hasn't got a gravestone. He hasn't even got a death certificate. I'm going to fire his ashes into space when we win the judicial review. So he hasn't got a grave. And because the inquest was only yesterday, I haven't got a death certificate. But somebody has officially recognised why he died. And that is a good start. So, you know, it just says in some ways that Jason was here and we're going to get laws changed in his and Alexandra's name.
All right. That's Claire Mercer, whose husband was killed by a lorry on the M1 on a so-called smart motorway. Thanks for joining us. I'm always in awe when I speak to people like Louis Rudd, because not only is he a former officer in the Royal Marines, former member of the SAS, the crack elite squad, he's also the first Briton and only the second person overall to ski solo across Antarctica, which makes me feel incredibly inadequate when I feel incredibly chuffed when I manage to do my 12,000 steps in a day. Louis Rudd joins me now. Where did you get your daring do instincts from, Louis Rudd? Because you've led a team of army reservists across Antarctica, which took you 67 days. You've served in for the Royal Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it seems no challenge is too great for you.
Yeah, I think I was inspired from a really young age. I remember I was about 12 years old, and I'd actually got myself in a bit of trouble at school. I'd been sent to see the headmaster, and I was sat outside his office in this reception room waiting to go in to be caned, actually, and pretty terrified. And there was a little bookshelf off to the side while I was sat there waiting. I just randomly grabbed this book, and it was a little ladybird book titled Captain Scott. And at that point, I'd never heard of, you know, Captain Scott, polar explorers, you know, Antarctica. It wasn't covered in the school curriculum. And I just remember flicking through this book and looking at these, you know, incredible images and reading the story of this amazing expedition and these guys, you know, their life and death struggle to try and be the first people to reach the South Pole. And I just found it really inspiring and, you know, instantly thought, yeah, I want to go down to this place and just experience a polar journey for myself. And carried on then reading more polar history as I was growing up, and the likes of Shackleton and Armiton. So, yeah, you know, I think that's what it was, about kind of role models from a young age.
Royal Marines, I think you were quite young when you joined up. You were 16, I think.
Yeah, I was, yeah. So yeah, the earliest, you know, the youngest you can join, straight out of school, finished my O-levels and then signed up to join the Marines for a life of adventure.
And do you think it was the military discipline of the Marines, 3 decades in the Marines, that enabled you to do that first trip to Antarctica? What was that, back in 2011, 2012? You skied 800 miles over 67 days, unsupported?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I think definitely being in the military has helped with not only, I guess, my physical sort of robustness, but I think more importantly, my mental robustness and sort of, I guess, being used to taking on very sort of challenging things in the military, then transferred across into the exploration world. So I think, yeah, I believe that's an advantage, and just the discipline of the routines that you have to adopt, you know, during a polar journey as well. All that was, I guess, instilled in me from quite a young age.
I'd have thought most people, having done a trip like that once, would be enough. But then 5 or 6 years later, you led a team of 5 Army reservists on another 67-day, 1,100-mile traverse of Antarctica, skiing unsupported to the South Pole. How terrifying is it on those trips? The cold, the potential hunger, the fear of frostbite, getting lost, a blizzard. What, I mean, do you get scared?
You do. And I, on that first trip, the one you mentioned in 2011, I went with a guy called Henry Worsley, and I swore blind when we got to the South Pole. It was such a grueling and difficult journey. I got a bit of frostbite in my fingers, and I just made so many mistakes because it was my first expedition. And I got to remember getting to the South Pole and turning to Henry and saying, I am never, ever coming back to this place. It was just been like brutal. But it's funny how over time your memory kind of changes and you forget the bad bits and some of the hardships and just seem to remember the really good, parts of it, the stunning scenery and, the sense of achievement of finally getting to the pole. And then
you did it all over again 5 or 6 years later.
Then I went back because on that first trip, I was a team member and Henry was the expedition leader. And I learned a huge amount about leadership, from him during that journey. And I then wanted to go back and lead a team then myself, on a full crossing of the continent, which was, and that journey ended up being a tribute to Henry, because very sadly, the year before we left, he lost his life in Antarctica attempting a solo unsupported cruise.
Really?
So
did he? And that didn't put you off?
No, quite.
Because you think he'd have wanted you to do it?
We wanted, as a team, we wanted to go down and really honour his legacy, attempt that same journey that he'd been attempting solo, and we did, and we got to the point where Henry ground to a halt, which was only 100 miles from completing his planned journey, and from that point on it was all about doing that last 100 miles on his behalf and finishing the trip. So it meant a lot to us as a team to be able to go down there and complete that on his behalf.
You're raising lots of money for charity on the way, the Royal British Legion, also the Soldiers Charity. 2018, it's a mere 570 kilometres of the Greenland ice sheet. And then probably the big one, 2018-2019, the Spirit of Endurance, 56 days, 920 miles solo, unsupported, crossing of the Antarctic landmass. The first Brit to do it and only the second ever to complete this journey in the world. That's quite an accolade.
That was definitely the most difficult trip I've ever done. But I felt with all the experience, that I'd accumulated on the previous expeditions, that I was then in a position to go down and safely, attempt, say, a solo journey. And I'd never done anything solo before, so that was definitely the big unknown component, and it is, it's more difficult in a team. You change over, the lead man every hour, because when you're up front, it's a little bit harder, because you're breaking through the fresh snow, you're having to navigate, you're concentrating on the compass to make sure you're skiing a straight line towards the South Pole, you're looking out for crevasses, and then you find once you've done your stint at the front, you drop in on the back of the team, and you're in a cut track, and it's just a bit easier, and you can put your music on and just kind of zone out a bit. But solo,
just a bit easier, he says. Just a bit easier. I don't think anybody listening to this would think any of this sounds easy.
But you
did it, and and you got the Scientific Exploration Society Explorer of the Year 2019 award. You have family, don't you?
I do. Yes. So I've got three.
What are your wife? And what did your wife make of it when you said, "Bye, darling"? I said I'd never go back to the Antarctic. Well, not only am I going back, I'm going on my own for 56 days. Was your wife appalled, or was she very supportive? Be honest now.
I'm going to be honest, and I'm really lucky that my wife Lucy, has always been supportive of my expeditions, on that front. She knows how much it means to me. She knows how passionate I am about Antarctica, and I've been very lucky, and likewise, children were a little bit apprehensive, obviously, because they'd seen what had happened with Henry on his journey, but I just reassured them that I had mitigated the risk, as much as you possibly can for that kind of journey, and assured them that if at any point I felt things were getting a bit too dangerous, that I would look to abort the trip. So with all those assurances in place, then I was very fortunate to have the backing of my family.
And now you're focusing, you consult for others who are doing polar journeys, you do specialist training, expedition management, you're also an ambassador for the Soldiers Charity. Are you planning yet another trip? Have you broken that? And if you have you broken the news to your wife Lucy yet?
I am planning another expedition.
Where are you off to?
It would be Antarctica again. Obviously, very passionate about Antarctica, and I'm just it's not confirmed yet, but I'm in initial discussions with a wounded army veteran who was shot in Afghanistan. He's partly disabled, and we're looking to I'm looking to guide him from the coastline of Antarctica to the South Pole. He will be the first ever disabled person to complete a full ski journey to the South Pole. So a very exciting, you know, project, and we're looking to fundraise again for some amazing causes off the back of it as well. So
How many days do you estimate that's going to take you with this guy?
50. So we're looking at a 720-mile journey, and we expect it will take around about 50 days. He's paralysed in one arm.
Did he sustain that injury in the army on the front line in Afghanistan?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was shot and wounded in Afghanistan while deployed on operations.
Well, yet again, I'm awestruck. But Louis, it's been a great privilege to talk to you. That's Louis Rudd, explorer, former officer in the British Army and Royal Marines. Are we turning into a nation of health signalers, constantly spamming each other with updates about smug fitness trends such as wild swimming, whatever that is, or bath time braggers? Even more fascinating. The female writer Claudia Connor wonders why runners insist on telling us about their routes. She's written an incredible piece in the paper today. So, Claudia, what is it all about, health signalers?
Well, it's about showing off. And there's absolutely nothing wrong in wanting to get fitter, wanting to get healthier. But it's just wanting the whole world to know about it. And most of the people that I'm talking about here are just vain selfie takers. It's nothing to do with fitness. It's just to do with getting a selfie on social media and showing off.
Explain to me about bath braggers, as long as it's respectable, because this is a family podcast, Claudia.
Okay.
We don't no smut here.
Well, this is a thing, and it really sort of took off during the first lockdown. So lots of celebrities posted pictures of themselves in the bath, like Liz Hurley did it, Madonna did it. So surrounded by scented candles, bubbles carefully arranged not to expose any rude bits, but all sort of beautifully photographed. And the bathtub has to be a very deep sort of, like, you normally a freestanding clawfoot bath. And it's just, you know, when did we share having a bath, you know?
Yeah, when did we? Tell me what a wild swimmer is.
Well, wild swimming is what used to be called open water swimming. So it's people who don't swim in pools. So they might swim in ponds and lakes and in the sea. So they swim outdoors, especially during winter.
And they like to show off about it.
Yeah, they like to show off. They post pictures of themselves sort of being brave and going into the freezing English Channel. And it's, again, you know, fine, do it, but just shut up about it.
Exactly. Why do they have to? And now I love this, the step counters. Now, I am obsessive, Claudia, about doing my 10,000 steps every day, but I don't bore people about it. I don't really tell anyone whether I've done it or not, but I know today I've done 8,500 steps. I'm going to have to go out for another walk today to get me up to 11,000. But that doesn't make me a step counter bore, does it? Or does it make me a step counter bragger?
I think you might be borderline there, Andrew. What would you do if it gets to bedtime and you're on 9,200? Would you have to do those last 800 before you went to bed?
I would have done them already.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I'm not going to pace around the flat because my two cats would think what's the matter with him?
Okay.
Because they know the routine, the lights go out and all that. But I mean, your point is it's the show-offs, isn't it? That's what this has become. And do you think it's got worse since lockdown?
Yes, I do. And these are what I would call the super step counters. So they would laugh in the face of 10,000 steps. They're looking at doing 20,000 plus. So which is, I mean, that would be about the equivalent, I would say, of about walking 10 miles a day. So yeah, they would not consider 10,000 pounds sort of brag, 10,000 steps rather bragworthy.
Yeah. And what is a self-care show-off?
Oh, so these are the ones that this is all about. I don't know if you recall the sort of the Heidi craze that everyone was talking about a few years ago. So it's about sort of being cozy at home. And obviously this became a big thing during lockdown. So looking after yourself, having a pyjama day, you know, lighting candles, taking a day off work, things like that, which is a nice thing to do. But again, it has become a social media trend where everybody basically wants to show off how nice their living room is and how expensive their sofa was.
Yeah. And the self-righteous booze banners was my favourite, as you say, while everyone else is cracking open the Pinot Noir because we got to drink our way through this terribly depressing lockdown. They're banging on about how there are more calories in half a bottle of wine than in a vegetable stir fry.
Yeah, that's it. Well, I think a lot of, I did think, well, I'm going to do dry January. But then as soon as the sort of second lockdown was started, that was just out the window.
Did you have a dry day?
I think I've managed 3 days.
Yeah, do you know, actually, I am doing dry January, so perhaps I am turning into an utter bore, but I don't think I'm telling too many people about it, and I'm certainly not saying I'd rather have a stir-fried vegetable than a glass of wine, because I know what I'm gagging for right now, and it's not a stir-fry.
You're going to hold out. You've done well if you've got this far.
Do you think so? Yeah. And just finally, is it the mediators? What are they?
Oh, no, meditators. So people who like to meditate. So, you know, nothing wrong with meditating, but it has become about sort of showing off. And it's a certain type of woman that does this. I would say the sort of like the Notting Hill Trustafarian types who don't have to work and sit around in their expensive loungewear, cross-legged, showing off to everybody.
Followers of that idiot woman who used to be a sort of reasonable actress, Gwyneth Paltrow, because she's gone mad, hasn't she? Slightly.
Oh, yes. Yes. Wallowed her. Yes. Gloopy. Her lifestyle website. Yes. Yes. It's become a trend, sort of meditating, but meditating, obviously, wearing the right clothes and with the right sort of styling.
Yeah, exactly. So last question, Claudia, how many steps have you done today?
Oh, God, you know what? I think I haven't even reached 5,000 yet, which is pretty awful, isn't it? So,
well, that's all right. That means you're not a smug health signaller.
Well, it does, yeah. I should be, yes.
So there we are. Thank heavens for small mercies. Claudia Connor, who is always a joy on this podcast and has written a very, very entertaining piece about smug health signaller. I've got to tell you, Claudia, I often go for a walk on the Heath in Hampstead, which is near where I live. My God, they're all out there.
You'll probably see the wild swimmers there as well, won't you, in the ponds?
I now know what you mean. You talked about because there are ponds there. Yeah, they're in there wearing very little clothes in icy cold weather, showing off.
With their selfie sticks out.
Yeah, all of that as I walk past, wrapped from top to toe in my woolies and my pullies and my bobble hats and trainers and gloves and all the rest of it. Claudia, thanks for joining us. That's Claudia Connell talking about smug health signallers. Well, that's all from the Best of the Daily Show with me, Andrew Pearce. Remember, you can tune into the regular show Monday to Friday at 5 p.m. on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. Have yourselves a great weekend and goodbye.